Patience here.
Oh, boy, got some blood going.
Yeah, blood.
He's wearing it, too.
Welcome to the bed. When you get over to the bed, we'll go ahead and give you the story. This is all going to happen super fast. Welcome to the emergency room.
70-year-old female, single driver of a vehicle. Appears that she went off-road into a ditch, rolled over her car onto a trailer, caved in. The top of the vehicle was caved in, and she was hanging out partially from the window.
She's giving her left hand. 45 minutes of CPR.
Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we're tackling something absolutely critical in med-surg and emergency care: initial trauma assessment. Our mission is to really break down those dense protocols into the high-yield stuff you actually need to know.
Exactly. We're essentially building an exam-ready review guide, focusing on that initial trauma assessment and management.
Because in trauma, it really is about speed and sequence, isn't it? It's not just theory.
Oh, absolutely not. It's like a well-rehearsed dance, the choreography of survival, you could say. And the sources we looked at really emphasize that Pareto principle. You know, the 80-20 rule.
Right. That 20% of knowledge gives you 80% of the results.
Precisely. And in trauma, that 20% is arguably the primary survey, the ABCDEs. Get that right? And you're covering the vast majority of immediate life-saving interventions.
So that's our goal today. To give you that critical 20%, unpack the whole sequence from prep and triage right through the primary and secondary surveys.
And we're going to focus hard on the protocols, yeah, but also the nursing implications, the why behind the steps. And importantly, those little pitfalls. The things that can trip you up.
The things that separate, you know, effective action from potentially catastrophic delay.
Yeah. We want you to walk away understanding not just what to do, but the immediate physiological reasons why, and those tiny details that honestly make a huge difference in outcomes. The stuff that shows up on exams.
Okay, let's dive in. Trauma care really starts before the patient even arrives. So, section one, The foundation preparation, safety, and triage. The setup.
Mm-hmm. Advanced planning is everything. The sources are clear. A smooth trauma response starts way before that ambulance backs in. It begins with meticulous preparation.
So what does that actually look like? A ready trauma bay?
Well, first, the resuscitation area itself has to be available, like immediately. But just having the space isn't enough.
Right. What needs to be in the space and ready?
Okay, think airway first. All your airway equipment, laryngoscopes, different sized ET tubes, maybe video scopes, even your cricothyrotomy kits. Everything needs to be organized, tested, and you have to know it's working.
Because equipment failure during an airway attempt is...
Yeah, it's a nightmare. It's an absolute failure of prep, and the protocols hammer this home. Yeah. Prevent it at all costs. Test that gear.
And we know hypothermia is a huge issue in trauma, and part of that lethal triad. What about temperature prep?
Crucial point. You absolutely need warmed intravenous crystalloid solutions ready to go. Ideally, they're stored right around, say, 37 to 40 degrees Celsius.
Why is that so critical? Room temp fluid doesn't seem that cold.
But if a patient needs liters of fluid and you're pouring in room temp saline or LR, you can plummet their core body temperature really fast, and that just tanks their ability to clot. It accelerates coagulopathy.
Gotcha. So warmed fluid's ready. What else for prep?
You need established protocols for getting help fast. Calling in the lab, getting radiology stats, summoning extra hands, surgical teams, respiratory, whatever you need. And importantly, the hospital needs solid transfer agreements with verified trauma centers.
Verified trauma centers. That's key for system planning.
Definitely. And linked to that, let's talk safety for the team. Standard precautions. What's the minimum?
Right, because trauma is messy. Body fluids are expected.
Yeah, the ACS Committee on Trauma, OSHA, the CDC, they all mandate this. If you anticipate contact with body fluids, which you always should in trauma, it's immediate standard precautions. Face mask, eye protection goggles, or a shield, a water impervious gown, and gloves.
And that's done immediately on arrival.
Immediately, no delay. Protect yourself first so you can help the patient.
Okay, prep done. Now, triage. This is about sorting, right? Match needs to resources.
Fundamentally, yes. Sorting based on required resources versus what you actually have available. And treatment priority always follows the ABCs. But there's a critical distinction here, something that's highly testable.
The difference between multiple casualties and mass casualties.
Exactly. People often mix these up, but they mean very different things for how you operate clinically and ethically.
Explain multiple casualties first.
Okay. A multiple casualty incident, or MCI, means the number of patients and how badly they're hurt does not overwhelm your facility's capacity. You can handle it, basically.
So, standard priorities apply.
Right. You treat the sickest first, the ones with immediate life threats like major bleeding or airway blockage or complex multi-system injuries. That's your standard approach.
Now contrast that with a mass casualty event, or MCE.
This is where the game changes dramatically. In an MCE, the number of patients or the severity of their injuries does exceed your capability. You're overwhelmed.
So the priority shifts.
It has to. The focus flips from saving every single individual, no matter the cost, to achieving the greatest good for the greatest number of people.
Meaning?
Meaning you prioritize patients who have the greatest chance of survival and require the least expenditure of your limited resources, time, staff, equipment, supplies.
Wow. So someone needing complex, lengthy surgery might actually be delayed?
Yes. If that patient has a low chance of survival, even with the surgery, and those same resources could save three other patients with simpler injuries and excellent prognoses, the protocol shifts. You treat the three. It's a harsh reality of disaster triage.
That ethical pivot from individual focus to population focus is huge.
Yeah.
Okay, finally in this section, transfer logistics. Who decides where a badly injured patient goes?
That decision often starts in the field with pre-hospital personnel, paramedics, EMTs. They use specific scoring systems, like the revised trauma score or mechanism criteria, to gauge injury severity.
And the goal is?
The goal is to get the most severely injured patients directly to a verified trauma center if one is reasonably accessible. Avoid the pit stop at a smaller hospital that can't provide definitive care.
Because secondary transfers waste precious time.
Exactly. Time is tissue, time is life in trauma. Sending a major trauma patient to a hospital without, say, 24/7 surgical capability or neurosurgeon available is a system failure you want to avoid.
Makes sense. Okay, preparation done, triage considered, patients rolling in. Now we hit the absolute core, the primary survey with simultaneous resuscitation, ABCDE.
This is it. The rapid sequential assessment looking for and treating immediate life threats based on physiology, not necessarily the specific anatomical injury yet.
And it's fast, sequential, but also simultaneous.
Right. We talk about it as A, then B, then C, but a good trauma team is often doing things concurrently. Someone's managing the airway while someone else is getting IV access, while another is exposing the patient. But the assessment logic follows ABCDE and the golden rule: find a life threat, fix it immediately, then move on.
Okay, let's break it down. A, airway maintenance with restriction of cervical spine motion. How do you quickly assess if the airway is open?
The quickest way. Ask the patient a question. Can you tell me your name? What happened? If they can answer clearly, speak normally.
That tells you a lot, doesn't it?
It really does. It suggests the airway is patent, breathing is probably okay for now, and their brain is getting enough oxygen to be conscious and process language.
Mm-hmm.
Major compromise is unlikely at that moment.
But if they can't respond, where you hear gurgling or stridor or their voice is hoarse,
then you have to assume there's a major airway problem until you prove otherwise. Immediate intervention needed.
What are those initial interventions? Starting simple.
Least invasive first. A jaw thrust maneuver, fingers behind the angle of the jaw, lift forward, or a chin lift. Often just gets the tongue off the back of the throat.
And suction.
Absolutely critical. Aggressive suctioning to clear blood, vomit, teeth, whatever is obstructing the view or passage of air. Have large bore suction ready.
What about airway adjuncts, like an OPA or NPA?
Good temporary measures. An oropharyngeal airway, the OPA, goes in an unconscious patient with no gag reflex. If they gag, pull it out, it could cause vomiting. A nasopharyngeal airway, NPA, is better tolerated if the patient is semi-conscious or has a gag reflex. Lubricate it well.
When do these simple measures not cut it? When do you need a definitive airway and endotracheal tube?
There are clear indicators. The big one is a Glasgow Coma Scale score of 8 or less. GCS less than or equal to 8. That's the classic line.
But it's not just the GCS score.
No, not at all. You also need definitive control if there's any doubt about the patient's ability to maintain their own airway long term. Think about facial smash injuries, neck hematomas, inhalation burns things where swelling is inevitable and will close off the airway later.
So anticipating problems.
Yes. Also, altered level of consciousness, combativeness, making assessment impossible, or finding non-purposeful motor responses like decorticate or decerebrate posturing these strongly suggest the need for intubation to protect the airway and manage ventilation.
And all this airway management happens while protecting the neck.
Crucially, yes. Assume a cervical spine injury in any patient with significant trauma, especially above the clavicles or altered LOC. You'll likely apply a cervical collar.
But the collar can get in the way of intubation.
It does. So during the actual airway procedure, the front of the collar is typically opened and a dedicated team member performs manual restriction of motion MRM. One person's sole job is to hold the head and neck perfectly still, preventing flexion, extension, or rotation while the airway is secured.
That manual stabilization is key. What are the big pitfalls in airway management? Equipment failure, we mentioned.
That's a big one. Always check your laryngoscope light, cuff on the ET tube, have backup equipment ready. But the other major pitfall is progressive airway loss.
Meaning
the airway might be okay now, but due to swelling from burns or hematoma expansion in the neck, it could rapidly deteriorate. You must reassess the airway frequently. Don't just intubate and forget. Be prepared for a surgical airway, a cricothyrotomy, if intubation fails or isn't possible.
Constant vigilance. Okay, airway secured. Moving to breathing and ventilation. We need to know if air is actually getting in and out effectively.
Right. Airway patency isn't enough. Is the chest writhing and falling? Is it symmetrical? So first step, expose the neck and chest completely. Cut off the clothes. You need to see everything.
What are you looking for?
Look for obvious signs of injury, bruising, penetrating wounds, paradoxical movement where a segment of the chest wall sucks in during inspiration. That's a flail chest. Look at the neck veins. Are they distended, suggesting high pressure in the chest? Is the trachea midline or deviated?
And then listen.
Listen, auscultate both sides of the chest, high and low, front and back if possible. Are breath sounds present, equal, absent? And feel palpate the chest wall for tenderness, crepitus, that crackling sensation of air under the skin, subcutaneous emphysema, or instability.
You mentioned some immediate life threats under big. What are they again?
The ones needing immediate intervention in the primary survey are tension pneumothorax, massive hemothorax, open pneumothorax, a sucking chest wound, and sometimes flail chest if it's causing severe respiratory compromise.
Let's focus on tension pneumothorax.
Yeah.
It's always highlighted as incredibly urgent.
Because it kills fast. It's an injury where air gets into the pleural space between the lung and chest wall, usually from a lung tear, but it can't get out, like a one-way valve.
So air builds up.
Builds up under pressure. It collapses the lung on that side, sure, but worse, the pressure pushes the entire mediastinum, the heart, the great vessels, the trachea, over to the opposite side.
And that shift causes?
It kinks the great veins, especially the vena cava, cutting off blood return to the heart. No blood return, no cardiac output. That leads to rapid cardiovascular collapse and shock, plus respiratory failure.
How do you diagnose it? Do you wait for an X-ray?
Absolutely not. Waiting for X-ray confirmation of a tension pneumo is often fatal. The diagnosis is clinical, based on signs you see and hear right now. Respiratory distress, absent breath sounds on one side, neck vein distension, JVD, tracheal deviation away from the affected side, and hypotension.
And the immediate treatment?
Immediate needle decompression. A large bore needle, like a 14-gauge, inserted into the chest wall to let that trapped air escape.
Where exactly?
The classic location taught is the second intercostal space, midclavicular line, on the affected side. You go just over the top of the third rib to avoid the vessels underneath the second rib. You should hear a hiss of escaping air.
That buys time, right? It's not definitive.
Exactly. Needle decompression converts the tension pneumothorax back into a simple pneumothorax. It relieves the immediate pressure, but the definitive treatment is a chest tube inserted later.
Okay, crucial intervention. Now, for nursing care during BI, what's the universal first step for every trauma patient regarding oxygen?
Every single injured patient gets supplemental oxygen. No exceptions initially. If they're breathing on their own, put them on a high flow device, typically a non-rebreather mask with the reservoir bag inflated, aiming for close to 100% IO2.
And monitoring.
Continuous pulse oximetry, CO2. Yeah. But remember, it's limitations. It tells you saturation, not ventilation, how well they're clearing CO2 or the actual partial pressure of oxygen, PO2. And make sure the probe is working, not on a finger that's cold or has poor perfusion.
You mentioned a critical nursing pitfall earlier involving positive pressure ventilation. Can you remind us?
Yes, this is super important. If a patient has a simple pneumothorax, air in the pleural space, but not under tension yet, and you intubate them and put them on a ventilator before putting in a chest tube.
the positive pressure from the vent,
can rapidly force huge amounts of air through that lung tear into the pleural space, instantly converting a simple pneumothorax into a life-threatening tension pneumothorax. So if you suspect a pneumo, especially before bagging or ventilating, chest decompression needs to happen first or simultaneously.
Got it. Huge safety point. Okay, A and B addressed. We move to C, circulation with hemorrhage control. This is the big killer, right? Preventable deaths.
It absolutely is. Hemorrhage is the leading cause of preventable death after injury. So the mindset has to be, if a trauma patient is hypotensive, the cause is blood loss until proven otherwise. Assuming you've already ruled out tension pneumothorax, which can also cause obstructive shock.
How do you assess circulation quickly? Seconds count.
You look at three things almost instantly. One, level of consciousness. Is it decreased? An altered LOC can mean the brain isn't getting enough blood flow, enough perfusion. Two, skin perfusion. Look at their skin color and temperature. Is it pale, cool, clammy, ashen, gray? Especially in the extremities, that suggests shock, poor volume. Conversely, pink, warm skin, especially centrally, is usually a good sign initially.
Check a central pulse first, like the carotid or femoral. Is it fast, weak, thready? A rapid, thready pulse is a classic sign of hypovolemia, although it can sometimes be a late sign.
Okay, you've assessed, you suspect shock. How do you control the bleeding you can see? External hemorrhage.
Start simple. Direct manual pressure on the wound. Usually works for venous or smaller arterial bleeding. Apply firm pressure with gauze or your hand.
What if that's not enough, like massive arterial bleeding from a limb?
If direct pressure fails for life-threatening extremity hemorrhage, then tourniquets are indicated and life-saving. Apply it proximal to the wound, tighten until bleeding stops, and critically, note the time of application. They save lives but risk limb ischemia, so time is crucial.
What not to do for external bleeding?
Do not blindly clamp vessels in a deep wound with hemostats. You're likely to grab and damage nerves or the artery itself. Pressure is the key first step.
Okay, that's external. But the really dangerous bleeding is often internal. Where does massive internal hemorrhage hide?
There are five main places you look for large volume internal blood loss.
Yeah.
The blood on the floor and four more. One, chest, hemothorax. Two, abdomen, liver, spleen, lax, mesenteric injuries. Three, retroperitoneum, often from pelvic fractures or kidney injuries. Four, pelvis. Pelvic fractures can bleed massively from bone and veins. Five, long bones. A femur fracture can easily lose 1.5 liters of blood into the thigh.
So if you suspect, say, a pelvic fracture based on mechanism or instability, what's the immediate move?
Stabilize it immediately. Use a commercial pelvic binder or even just a sheet wrapped tightly around the greater trochanters and symphysis pubis. This helps close the book on the pelvic rim, reducing the volume the pelvis can bleed into and tamponading venous bleeding sources. It's a critical early step.
And for suspected bleeding in the chest or abdomen?
That usually requires definitive intervention, either immediate surgery or sometimes interventional radiology to embolize bleeding vessels. That's decided based on the primary survey findings and adjuncts like fast skin.
Let's talk resuscitation fluids. Access first.
You need reliable IV access, fast. The standard is two large-bore peripheral IV catheters. Think 14 or 16 gauge, maybe 18 in a pinch. Put them in the antecubital fossae or larger forearm veins if possible.
What if you can't get peripheral IVs quickly?
Don't waste time. Move immediately to intraosseous IO access, usually placed in the proximal tibia or humerus. IO access is fast, reliable, and you can infuse anything through it, fluids, blood, drugs. Central lines are also an option, but usually take longer and require more expertise. IO is often faster in an emergency.
Okay, access secured. What fluid do you give initially?
The standard initial approach is a bolus of warmed isotonic crystalloid, usually 1 liter for an adult, given rapidly. Lactated ringers or normal saline, and remember, warmed fluid is key.
Now, this is where it gets nuanced. You mentioned the lethal triad earlier, hypothermia, acidosis, coagulopathy. How does aggressive fluid resuscitation play into that, especially before bleeding is stopped?
This is a massive point in modern trauma care. Historically, we poured in crystalloids, but evidence now clearly shows that aggressive, uncontrolled volume resuscitation with crystalloids before the source of bleeding is surgically controlled can actually increase mortality.
Why is that? It seems counterintuitive.
Several reasons. One, dilutional coagulopathy. You're pouring in fluid that has no clotting factors, diluting the patient's own limited supply. Two, disrupting clots. Raising the blood pressure too high, too fast can literally pop the clot that might be forming at the injury site.
If the fluids aren't warmed, you're making the patient colder, which directly inhibits platelet function and clotting enzyme activity. Four, worsening acidosis. Massive fluid shifts and ongoing hypoperfusion contribute to metabolic acidosis, which also impairs clotting.
So dumping in liters of crystalloid can actually make bleeding worse and harder to stop.
Exactly. It fuels the lethal triad. The sources specifically mention that giving more than about 1.5 liters of crystalloid is independently associated with increased mortality in patients needing massive transfusion.
That 1.5 liter number is a really important benchmark. So this leads to the idea of permissive hypotension, or hypotensive resuscitation.
Correct. In penetrating trauma without brain injury, the goal is often to resuscitate just enough to maintain a palpable radial pulse or a target systolic pressure around 80-90 mmHg until the bleeding is surgically stopped. You're accepting a slightly lower pressure to avoid worsening the hemorrhage. This doesn't apply as much to blunt trauma, especially with head injury, where you need higher pressures to perfuse the brain.
So if the patient doesn't respond quickly to that initial crystalloid bolus, or they're clearly in severe shock,
you move to blood products much sooner. Balanced resuscitation with packed red blood cells, plasma, and platelets, often in a 1.1:1 ratio, mimicking whole blood.
And this is where tranexamic acid, TXA, comes in.
Yes. TXA is an antifibrinolytic. It helps stabilize clots that are already formed by preventing their breakdown. Evidence, especially from military settings, shows a survival benefit if given early to severely injured bleeding patients.
How early?
Ideally within 3 hours of the injury, often given as a 1 gram bolus over 10 minutes, followed by another 1 gram infusion over 8 hours. It's becoming standard practice in major trauma.
Okay, really key C-spine management points there.
Right.
What labs do you need stat during C?
You need baseline bloods immediately. A trauma panel usually includes a CBC, electrolytes, kidney function, coagulation studies, PTINR, PTT, and definitely a type and cross-match to get blood ready.
Anything else critical?
Yes. An arterial blood gas, ABG, or at least a venous blood gas with lactate. Lactate level is a key indicator of tissue hypoperfusion and shock. Trending lactate down shows your resuscitation is working. And crucially, for all females of childbearing age, a pregnancy test, HCG, is mandatory early on. It affects everything from medication choices to radiation exposure.
Got it. Moving to D, disability. The quick neurological check.
This is a rapid assessment of neurological function. You're primarily using the Glasgow Coma Scale, GCS. Assess eye-opening, verbal response, and motor response. The total score is out of 15, but the motor score, out of 6, is often considered the most predictive component for outcome.
What else are you checking under D?
Check pupil size and reactivity to light. Are they equal, round, reactive? A unilaterally dilated fixed pupil, blown pupil, is an ominous sign suggesting brain herniation. Also look for lateralizing signs. Does one side of the body move weaker than the other? And if there's any suspicion of spinal cord injury, assess for motor and sensory level.
Now, a critical thinking point. If the patient's level of consciousness, LOC, certainly drops during the primary survey, what's the first thing you suspect and reassess before jumping to neurosurgery consult?
Absolutely. The first thing is to reevaluate A, B, and C. A decrease in LOC is often caused by hypoxia, airway or breathing problem, or hypoperfusion, circulation problem shock, before it's due to a primary brain injury worsening.
So rule out the fixable systemic causes first.
Always. Check oxygen saturation, check breathing, check blood pressure and signs of shock. Is the ET tube still in place? Did they develop a tension pneumo? Are they becoming hypotensive again? Fix those ABC issues first. While CNS injury is common, you must treat reversible causes immediately. The nursing principle is always assume a change in LOC is due to CNS injury until proven otherwise, but your immediate actions are to recheck A, B, and C.
And the overall goal of D?
Prevent secondary brain injury. That means ensuring adequate oxygenation and perfusion to the brain. Early consultation with neurosurgery is vital if a significant brain injury is identified or suspected.
Okay, we finished the primary survey loop with E, exposure and environmental control.
Right. E means you need to completely undress the patient, cut off all their clothes. You have to be able to see everything front and back to look for injuries you might otherwise miss. Lacerations, bruises, deformities, impaled objects.
But exposing the patient creates another risk.
A huge risk. Hypothermia. This is the major environmental complication we need to prevent aggressively. Trauma patients lose heat incredibly fast. They're exposed, often wet, maybe lying on a cold backboard or floor and getting room temp or even cooled fluids initially.
And hypothermia is bad because
it's lethal. It directly worsens coagulopathy. Platelets don't work well. Clotting factors are less effective when you're cold. It impairs immune function, increases risk of infection, and stresses the cardiovascular system. It's a core component of that lethal triad. core temp below 35 degrees C, 95 degrees era, significantly worsens outcomes.
So what are the highest priority nursing actions for warming?
Be aggressive from the start. Cover the patient with warm blankets immediately after exposure. Use forced air warming devices like a bear hugger. Increase the ambient temperature of the trauma bay itself. And critically, as we said, administer warmed IV fluids, ideally through a high flow fluid warmer that gets them up to around 39 degrees C, 102.2 degrees air.
What about using a microwave for fluids?
Okay, this is a key point. You can warm crystalloid fluids like saline or LR in a microwave if protocols allow and you're careful. But never, ever warm blood products in a microwave. It destroys the red blood cells, hemolysis, and makes them useless and potentially harmful. Use approved blood warmers only.
Good distinction.
Okay.
Okay, that completes the primary survey cycle, ABCDE. Resuscitation is ongoing. Now we add adjuncts to the monitoring and diagnostic tools. Section 3, adjuncts to the primary survey.
Yeah, these are things done often concurrently or immediately following the primary survey to give us more information and monitor the patient's response to our interventions.
Like the ECG.
Right. Continuous ECG monitoring is standard. You're watching for dysrhythmias, maybe unexplained tachycardia, new atrial fibrillation, PVCs, heart blocks, or ST segment changes that could indicate blunt cardiac injury, mitochondrial contusion.
What about PEA, pulseless electrical activity?
Seeing organized electrical activity on the monitor but having no palpable pulse, PEA, is a critical finding. It often points towards reversible causes, the H's and T's, things like hypovolemia, hypoxia, hydrogen ion, acidosis, hyperkalemia, hypothermia, or tension pneumothorax, tamponade, cardiac, toxins, thrombosis, pulmonary or coronary. Finding PEA demands a rapid search for and treatment of an underlying cause.
Okay, ECG. Then pulse oximetry. We mentioned it under B. Remind us of the key limitations.
Main limitations. It measures oxygen saturation, SpO2, not the partial pressure of oxygen, PAT, or ventilation effectiveness, CO2. And it can be very unreliable in shock states due to peripheral vasoconstriction. The finger probe just might not pick up a good signal. Also unreliable with carbon monoxide poisoning.
And the practical pitfall.
Make sure the probe isn't on the same arm as an automatically cycling blood pressure cuff. The cuff inflation will cut off flow and give you a falsely low or absent reading. If the SpO2 reading doesn't match the clinical picture or the ABG, question the SpO2 reading first.
How else do we monitor ventilation, especially if the patient is intubated?
Besides respiratory rate, capnography measuring end-tidal CO2, ETCO2, is essential. It's the continuous waveform measurement of CO2 at the end of exhalation.
Its primary use.
Confirming correct endotracheal tube placement. If you're getting a consistent CO2 reading in waveform, the tube is in the trachea, not the esophagus. That's vital after intubation.
But it tells you more than just placement, right?
Oh, yeah. The ETCO2 level gives you real-time insight into ventilation, adequacy of breathing off CO2, perfusion, CO2 delivery to the lungs depends on cardiac output, and metabolism. A sudden drop in ETCO2 can signal loss of cardiac output, like during CPR, massive pulmonary embolism, circuit disconnection, or sudden severe hypotension.
And during CPR.
It's incredibly useful. A jump in ETCO2 during CPR is often the earliest sign of return of spontaneous circulation, RSE, sometimes appearing even before a palpable pulse returns.
Good tool. What about labs as adjuncts, ABG and lactate again?
We mentioned getting them under C, but they're also monitoring tools. A low pH acidosis and a high base deficit or high lactate level quantify the degree of shock the oxygen debt at the tissue level. Trending these values over time tells you if your resuscitation efforts are actually working to restore tissue perfusion. If lactate isn't clearing, you need to rethink your strategy.
Okay, monitoring covered. Now, catheter placement. Also adjuncts, but with critical contraindications. Urinary catheters first. Why put one in?
Primarily to monitor UN output. It's one of the most sensitive indicators of end organ perfusion, specifically renal perfusion and overall volume status. You need to know if the kidneys are getting enough blood flow.
What's the target output we're looking for?
For an adult, the target is at least 0.5 millimolar per kilogram per hour. For a child over 1 year old, it's 1 millilitre per kilogram per hour. Significantly less than that suggests inadequate resuscitation or kidney injury.
What's the absolute reason you would not place a Foley catheter initially?
Suspected urethral injury. You absolutely must assess for this before attempting catheterization.
Signs of urethral injury.
The cardinal signs are blood at the urethral meatus, the opening, significant perineal ecchymosis, bruising, or a high-riding or boggy prostate felt on rectal exam, though rectal exams are becoming less routine in initial trauma assessment. Scrotal hematoma is another sign.
If you see any of those signs.
You start a pee. Do not attempt to pass a Foley. You could turn a partial tear into a complete transection. The patient needs a retrograde urethrogram, or UG, first an X-ray study where contrast dye is injected into the urethra to check its integrity. Only if the REG is normal can you proceed with catheterization.
Non-negotiable safety step. Okay, what about gastric catheters, NG or OG tubes? Why are they used?
Mainly for gastric decompression, removing air and fluid from the stomach. Uh-huh. This reduces the risk of vomiting and aspiration, especially in patients with altered LOC or before surgery. It can also remove blood swallowed from facial injuries.
What's the contraindication for the usual nasal insertion, NG tube?
If you suspect a basilar skull fracture, specifically involving the cribriform plate, the thin bone at the base of the skull just above the sinuses, usually suspected with severe facial trauma, CSF leak from the nose or ears, or raccoon eyes battle sign.
Why is that a contraindication?
Because if that plate is fractured, the NG tube could potentially pass through the fracture site directly into the cranial vault into the brain. Catastrophic complication.
So if you suspect that fracture,
you insert the tube orally or gastric tube, OGT. Same purpose, safer route in that situation.
And a general pitfall when placing either NG or OG tubes.
They frequently trigger gagging and vomiting. You absolutely must have suction ready at the bedside and be prepared to turn the patient, log roll if C-spine injury is suspected, immediately to prevent aspiration if they vomit during placement.
Good preparation point.
Yeah.
Lastly, diagnostic studies as adjuncts, X-rays.
Used very judiciously during the primary survey and resuscitation phase. The two most common and highest yield initial films are an AP chest X-ray and an AP pelvis X-ray.
Why those two specifically?
Chest X-ray can quickly identify life threats like large hemothorax, pneumothorax, confirm ET tube and central line placement, or show a widened mediastinum suggesting aortic injury. Pelvis X-ray identifies unstable pelvic fractures that require immediate binding due to hemorrhage risk.
But the key principle with imaging.
Do not delay necessary transfer or definitive operative care just to get more complex imaging done. Get the essential films if they guide immediate resuscitation, but CT scans and other detailed studies often wait until a patient is more stable or at the definitive care facility.
What about bedside ultrasound FAST?
The FAST exam, focused assessment with sonography for trauma, is a rapid bedside ultrasound looking for free fluid, usually blood in key areas, around the heart, pericardial space, around the liver, hepatorenal space, Morton's pouch, around the spleen, splenorenal space, and in the pelvis, suprapubic view.
And EFAST?
EFAST is the extended FAST, which adds views of the lung splenoid to look for pneumothorax, absence of lung sliding, and hemothorax fluid.
What's the crucial takeaway from a FAST exam finding?
The most critical finding is intra-abdominal free fluid, blood, in a hemodynamically unstable patient. That combination is almost always an indication for immediate exploratory laparotomy. They need to go to the operating room right now to find and stop the bleeding.
And if they're stable, but the FAST is positive?
If they're hemodynamically stable but have blood on FAST, they still need urgent surgical consultation and likely further imaging like a CT scan, but they may not need the OR quite as emergently. Close monitoring is key as they can destabilize quickly. DPL, diagnostic peritoneal lavage, is another older technique to look for abdominal blood, but FAST has largely replaced it due to being non-invasive.
Okay, that covers the key adjuncts. So primary survey complete. Resuscitation ongoing, adjuncts providing data. Now we can finally move to the more detailed assessment. Section 4, the secondary survey and special considerations.
Exactly. The secondary survey only starts after the primary survey, ABCDE, is completed. Immediate life threats are addressed, resuscitation is well underway, and the patient's vital functions are stabilizing or showing improvement.
This is the head-to-toe exam.
Yes, the comprehensive head-to-toe physical examination, plus getting a more detailed history. It's methodical and aims to identify all injuries, not just the immediate life threats found in the primary survey.
How do you get the history? The patient might be unresponsive.
You rely heavily on pre-hospital providers, paramedics, EMTs, family members if present, or sometimes witnesses. The key mnemonic for the history is MPLE.
Allergies.
Medications, especially crucial, are anticoagulants, beta blockers, insulin.
Past medical history, illnesses, pregnancy. Always ask.
Last meal, important for aspiration risk and timing of surgery.
Events environment related to the injury, the mechanism.
Let's talk about events mechanism of injury, MOI. Why is knowing how they got hurt so important?
because the mechanism strongly predicts the likely pattern of injuries. It raises your index of suspicion for specific things.
Give us an example, like that bullseye windshield fracture.
Right. If EMS tells you the patient was an unrestrained driver in a head-on collision, and there's a starburst pattern on the windshield from their head hitting it, you must suspect. Cervical spine injury, closed head injury, potentially facial fractures. If the steering wheel is bent, you add blunt cardiac injury, myocardial contusion, possibly sternal fracture, anterior flail chest, and even traumatic aortic disruption to your list of concerns.
So MOI guides your focused exam during the secondary survey.
Precisely. A rear impact collision, high suspicion for C-spine hyperextension, whiplash, and associated soft tissue neck injuries, a fall from height. Suspect axial loading injuries, spine fractures, pelvic fractures, calcaneal heel fractures, and deceleration injuries to organs. Gunshot wound. You need to predict the path of the bullet and consider all structures along that path.
Okay, let's walk through the head-to-toe exam, highlighting key points. Eyes.
Perform the detailed eye exam early, ideally before facial swelling makes it impossible. Check visual acuity, if possible. Pupillary responses again. Extraocular movements. Can they move their eyes in all directions? Restricted movement might mean orbital fracture with muscle entrapment. And look for foreign bodies or penetrating trauma.
Cervical spine and neck again. Didn't we cover that in A?
We addressed airway and manual restriction in A. In the secondary survey, assuming the patient is now stable and cooperative, you might perform a formal clinical clearance if appropriate. This involves checking for midline tenderness, distracting injuries, neurological deficits, and intoxication.
Using specific criteria.
Yes, like the NXUS low-risk criteria, NLC, or the Canadian C-spine rules, CCR. If the patient meets these criteria, example alert, no intoxication, no midline tenderness, no focal neurodeficit, no painful distracting injury, you might be able to clear the C-spine clinically without imaging, depending on institutional protocol. But if there's any doubt, keep the collar on and get imaging.
What about penetrating neck wounds, like a stab wound?
Key point here. If a penetrating wound in the neck clearly goes deep to the platysma muscle, the thin sheet-like muscle just under the skin, it requires formal surgical evaluation, often including imaging or exploration in the OR. Do not probe these wounds in the ED. You could cause massive bleeding or introduce infection.
Okay. Moving down, chest exam gets repeated more thoroughly.
Yes. Look and feel again for missed rib fractures, flail segments. Listen carefully again to breath sounds in all fields. Palpate the entire clavicle and sternum.
Abdomen and pelvis. What's the danger here?
The biggest danger is a falsely reassuring initial exam. Internal abdominal injuries, like a slow bleed from the spleen or liver, might not cause significant pain or tenderness right away, especially if the patient has other painful injuries or altered LOC.
So serial exams are key.
Absolutely. Repeat the abdominal exam frequently, ideally by the same examiner. Look for developing tenderness, guarding, rigidity, or distension, and re-examine the pelvis, gently assess stability once if not done earlier. If the pelvis is tender or unstable, apply a binder and avoid further manipulation.
Why no repeated manipulation of the pelvis?
Because a fractured pelvis, especially an unstable open book fracture, bleeds profusely from the broken bone ends and the rich venous networks nearby. Repeatedly rocking or manipulating the pelvis can dislodge any early clots that are forming and trigger catastrophic, potentially uncontrollable hemorrhage. Stabilize it and leave it alone.
Got it. Musculoskeletal system next. Looking for
obvious deformities, swelling, bruising, lacerations over bones, checking pulses distal to fractures, assessing motor and sensory function in all limbs. Don't just focus on the obvious long bone fracture. Check joints above and below and assess the entire limb.
And the limb-threatening condition nurses must always suspect.
Compartment syndrome. Especially with high-energy injuries like crush injuries, tibial fractures, forearm fractures, or even circumferential burns. Swelling inside a tight fascial compartment cuts off blood flow, leading to muscle death and nerve damage if not treated quickly, usually by fasciotomy.
How do you recognize it, especially in someone who can't communicate well?
The classic signs are the PS, pain out of proportion to the injury, often the earliest sign, paresthesias, numbness, tingling, pallor, pulselessness, a very late and ominous sign, and poikilothermia, coolness. But in an unresponsive patient, you rely on physical signs. A tense, swollen, firm-feeling compartment, and pain with passive stretch of the muscles in that compartment. Maintain a very high index of suspicion.
Okay, that's the head-to-toe. But the secondary survey isn't the end, is it?
Not at all. It really transitions into ongoing monitoring and reevaluation. You have to keep reassessing. Vital signs, pulse oximetry, urine output, neurological status, patients can deteriorate, new injuries can manifest. Continuous vigilance is the nursing priority.
What about pain management during this phase?
Important for patient comfort and reducing stress response. Use IV opiates like fentanyl or morphine in small, titrated doses. Anxiolytics, like midazolam, can also be helpful. But be judicious, don't oversedate and mask neurological changes or cause hypotension. And absolutely avoid intramuscular IM injections.
Why no IM shots?
Because trauma patients often have unpredictable muscle perfusion due to shock, so absorption is erratic. More importantly, if they need surgery or develop coagulopathy, that IM injection site can bleed significantly and form a large hematoma. Stick to IV or IO routes.
Okay, that covers the secondary survey. Now, let's touch on adapting care for special patient populations. Kids first. What's the biggest challenge with pediatric trauma?
Their amazing ability to compensate. Kids have incredible physiologic reserve. They can maintain a normal blood pressure and heart rate for a surprisingly long time, despite significant blood loss or shock.
Which sounds good, but...
But it's deceptive. Because when they finally decompensate, the crash is sudden, precipitous, and often catastrophic. Their vital signs might look okay one minute, and they're in profound shock the next. You have to anticipate shock based on mechanism and subtle signs, not wait for hypotension.
And everything is weight-based.
Everything. Fluid boluses, typically 20 milliEcG, blood products, medications, all meticulously calculated based on weight in kilograms. Huge potential for error if you're not careful. Equipment sizes are also different, obviously.
Pregnant patients next. How does pregnancy change things?
Profoundly. Anatomically, the enlarging uterus displaces abdominal organs, making injury patterns different and potentially masking abdominal signs. Physiologically, their blood volume increases by 30-50%, so they can lose a lot of blood, maybe 30-35% of their total volume, before showing classic signs of shock like tachycardia or hypotension.
So vital signs can be misleading again.
Very misleading. Also, the supine position can cause the gravid uterus to compress the vena cava, decreasing venous return and causing hypotension even without blood loss, supine hypotensive syndrome. Always tilt the pregnant trauma patient slightly to their left side if possible. And remember, there are two patients, mom and fetus. Fetal monitoring is crucial once mom is stabilized. Early pregnancy detection, HCG test, is vital.
Geriatric patients, what are the key considerations?
Diminished physiologic reserve is the main theme. Older adults just don't bounce back like younger people. They often have pre-existing conditions, heart failure, COPD, diabetes, kidney disease, that complicate their response to injury and resuscitation.
And medications.
Huge factor. Many are on beta blockers, which blunt the tachycardic response to shock, diuretics, making them volume depleted baseline, or anticoagulant Santa platelets, making them bleed much more easily. You have to assume even minor vital sign changes might represent significant underlying compromise. They're at high risk for both over-resuscitation, fluid overload, and under-resuscitation.
Lastly, the athlete. Seems like they'd be easy.
Ironically, no. Their excellent cardiovascular conditioning can mask shock. They often have a lower resting heart rate, bradycardia, and lower baseline blood pressure. So a heart rate of 90 or 100, which might seem okay in an average adult, could represent significant shock in a highly conditioned athlete. Similarly, their normal low BP might delay recognition of hypovolemia. You risk under-resuscitation if you use standard vital sign triggers.
Interesting. You have to know their baseline, or at least consider their conditioning. Okay, final section. Teamwork, transfer, and logistics. Trauma care is a team sport.
Absolutely. Effective trauma resuscitation depends on a coordinated team effort.
Who leads the team? What's their role?
There should be a designated team leader. Their job is to supervise the entire process, assign specific roles to team members, like you manage the airway, you get IV access, you scribe, constantly monitor the patient's progress through the ABCDEs, integrate information, and make critical decisions.
Should the leader be hands-on doing procedures?
Ideally, no. The sources emphasize that the team leader should try to maintain a big-picture view, standing back slightly, observing, thinking ahead, and directing the team, rather than getting bogged down and performing a specific task themselves.
Communication in that chaotic environment must be challenging. How do you make it work?
Closed-loop communication is essential. It prevents errors. When the leader gives an order, they direct it to a specific person by name. For example, Sarah, please give 1 liter of warmed normal saline.
And Sarah responds.
Sarah must repeat the order back, giving 1 liter warmed normal saline. Then, after she does it, she confirms completion. 1 liter is infusing. That loop ensures the order was heard correctly, understood, and executed. No assumptions.
What about the handover from EMS? That first report is critical.
It is. A structured handover prevents information loss. The MIST acronym is often used.
Mechanism of injury, how did it happen, and time of injury.
Injuries found or suspected by EMF.
Symptoms reported by the patient and signs observed by EMS, vital signs, GCS.
Treatment initiated in the field. Fluids, oxygen, splinting, meds like TXA.
MIST it. Good mnemonic. Okay, transfer decisions. When does a patient need to be moved to a higher level of care?
The basic principle is transfer is needed when the patient's injuries or care requirements exceed the capabilities of the current facility. This could be based on their physiologic status, unstable despite resuscitation, specific anatomical injuries, severe head injury needing neurosurgery, complex orthopedic fractures, the mechanism itself, high-risk MOI, or significant comorbidities.
And the rule about diagnostics before transfer.
The crucial rule is, do not delay transfer simply to perform extensive diagnostic tests that won't change the immediate management needed for safe transport. Perform only the tests necessary to stabilize the patient for the transfer. Get them to the place that can provide definitive care quickly.
Finally, records and legal stuff. Documentation.
Meticulous, accurate, and timed documentation is absolutely essential. Often, a dedicated scribe is part of the trauma team, whose sole job is to record everything. Vital signs, interventions, medications, fluids, personnel present, times of events. This record is vital for continuity of care and has major legal implications.
What about consent? Can you treat without it?
In a true life-threatening emergency where the patient cannot consent, unconscious, altered, the principle of implied consent applies. You provide necessary life-saving treatment based on the assumption that a reasonable person would consent under the circumstances. Formal consent is obtained later, if possible.
And if there's potential criminal activity involved, forensic evidence.
The trauma team has a responsibility to help preserve evidence if possible without compromising patient care. This means carefully handling clothing, cutting around bullet holes, not through them, saving any bullets or foreign objects removed, bagging items properly, and potentially drawing forensic labs like blood alcohol or drug screens if indicated and permitted by law or policy. Chain of custody might be involved for specific items handed to law enforcement.
Okay, we've covered a tremendous amount of ground there. Let's try to summarize the core message.
I think the recap is really about the sequence and the priorities. Preparation is foundational. Triage directs resources. Then it's that strict adherence to the ABCDE sequence for the primary survey, fixing life threats as you find them. Understanding the why behind things, like permissive hypotension or the contraindications for catheters, getting those adjuncts like monitoring and FAST, and only then moving to the detailed secondary survey.
And recognizing those subtleties, the pitfalls, the special populations.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Knowing why an athlete's vitals might fool you, or why you need TXA early, or the exact spot for needle decompression. That's the 20% of focus knowledge that leads to the 80% of good outcomes we talked about at the start. It's about mastering the fundamentals and the critical exceptions.
Yeah, that shift away from just dumping crystalloid towards balanced resuscitation, permissive hypotension, early TXA, it feels like a real evolution in understanding trauma physiology.
It really is. It's all about stopping the bleeding and combating that lethal triad, hypothermia, acidosis, coagulopathy, much, much earlier in the process.
Which brings us to our final provocative thought for you, the listener.
Thinking about how care is evolving.
Right. So consider this. Given everything we've discussed about the risks of aggressive crystalloid resuscitation before hemorrhage is controlled, and the proven benefits of agents like tranexamic acid given early, even pre-hospital, how might the increasing use of these kinds of pharmacological interventions right at the start, maybe even in the field, fundamentally change how we define immediate resuscitation?
Does definitive care, in a way, start the moment TXA is pushed by paramedics, well before the patient even sees a surgeon?
And what are the ripple effects of that? Does it change the training and scope of practice needed for first responders? Does it redefine when the clock truly starts on definitive trauma management? Something to think about as these protocols continue to evolve.